Provinsing ya Gauteng, provinsing ya Tshwane, ke leloko la komiti e, ke a leboga.
Good day everyone, Mpumelelo Mpisi, a researcher for the Portfolio Committee on Police. Thank you.
Good afternoon, honourable members. My name is Patricia Whittle. I'm a researcher for the Select Committee on Security and Constitutional Development.
Oh, good afternoon, everyone. My name is Sue Ann Isaac, and I'm a researcher for the Justice Committee.
Good afternoon, Chairperson. My name is Yohan de Lange. I'm from the Department of Justice Legislation Development.
Good afternoon. I'm Zalma Jansen. I'm from the Law Society of South Africa.
Good afternoon. I'm Peter Daniels. I'm the researcher for the Joint Standing Committee on Defense.
Good afternoon. Here we are by the Professor.
Thank you very much for the introduction. Let me welcome members of the Portfolio Committee. The Okay, we will allow that because the Honorable Ndlovu is saying so. Yes, we respect that. Let me welcome again, I was saying, welcome the members of the Portfolio Committee from the short constituency period we had, and I want to believe that even if it was that short, they did get time to visit one or two police stations, and probably they have a story to tell, but it will definitely not be today. I just want to highlight a few things. One, that we don't have time. This is the beginning of our third term of this year. And we are allocated to convene our meetings on Tuesday. And counting Tuesdays from today, we only have 8 Tuesdays. If you count today's Tuesday, otherwise it will be 7 Tuesdays. Then it will be the end of the year constituency period and they leave and such, as such. Looking into that and the many items and issues that we need to cover during this period, these days, these 7 Tuesdays are not enough. That will actually mean that we have to have meetings on other days other than Tuesdays. I'm saying this because one will really request maximum cooperation from the members of the Portfolio Committee. We are forced to have a meeting on Tuesday in the morning, but also to use the afternoon on Tuesday because the sitting starts at 2 up to 3 and we are forced to have meetings from 3 up to 5 and we'll request members to cooperate with us on that arrangement because probably it's a new arrangement. But also we will be having meetings on Friday. We intended to have even meetings on Wednesdays, but we're told there are members that are sitting in defense, and defense is sitting on Wednesdays, and we cannot therefore convene or have our meetings on Wednesday. We have quite a number of bills that are before the committee, but will also be before the Portfolio Committee. The Safety at Sports and Recreation is the bill that we should be part of processing, and this one as well. We will indeed inform members that our view is that for Safety at Sports and Recreational Events Bill, we rather have a subcommittee, because if as the whole committee we take that as our program, we'll never be able to cover our work at all. We will not process this bill that is before us. But we will be monitoring the processes that are taking place there with some few members that will sit permanently in the processing of that bill. Where we think we should attend as a portfolio committee, we will always attend. But we think we can ensure that our views are heard in that the processing of that bill, even if we are not as the whole committee sitting and processing that bill. Otherwise, it would mean it will just be that bill, then of course few other things, and that will be the end of this year. Even if we were to use 5 days in a week, would still not cover the amount of work that we intend to cover during this term. And it is for that reason that I think on this very first day, I must request members to be prepared to sacrifice, if it calls for sacrificing, but of course to cooperate with us so that we can, at the end of this term, say this is what we managed to do, and probably it is reasonable in our terms. I also want to welcome the officials from departments who are going to lead us today in the presentation on Criminal Law Forensic Procedure Amendment Bill. The leader will, of course, be our research, Parliament Research Unit, but they know how they have structured the presentations. We will allow them to do it as they have planned it, and then we'll allow members to ask questions for clarity, and then we'll take it from there. Because of time, I think we only have 2 hours from now up to 5. I will therefore not take much time on other things. I think there may be a lot that I want to say, but for now, that will be all. Let me therefore hand over to Mr. Mbisi to lead us, and then of course you will know how you've planned your presentation.
Thanks, Jefferson.
May I pray for your indulgence, Chairperson? There is a letter which is addressed to you, Chairperson, that we received about the other thing, but now it impacts on your program, which is talking about private members' proposal, something like that, which the meeting started 3:15 to 5:30. I don't know what is your take on it. I'm just asking before the presentation starts, do you know anything about it? What do we do about it and so on? Because it's one of your members who's supposed to be here. I think she's doing a presentation somewhere about that. V454, something like that. I'm just asking for the information and the procedural matter. Because the letter has already landed on our desk, Jefferson. Thank you very much.
No, I also did get the letter, but I should think we'll have to prioritize this meeting. Yes, we will have to go ahead with the meeting. Probably we might ask one member to just go there, but I think we can go ahead with the meeting.
Chair, seeing as you've raised it now, I was going to support your suggestion there that we get one member of the portfolio committee just to go there and listen to the presentation. So maybe we'll consult amongst ourselves if that's okay, and we'll just send somebody there. Okay, I can. I was going to suggest that we ask Honourable Annelies van Beek to represent us there.
Supported. Name being supported, it actually means that Annelies will be allowed to just go to that meeting on our behalf. We will request that as soon as the meeting is over, she comes back until 5 o'clock. Okay, over to you, Mr. Lee.
Thanks, Jefferson, and good day to honorable members and everyone again. we're here to make a presentation. Actually, it's in an information sharing session that we're having, and we are privileged to have people who have been with us before when we were doing or dealing with this bill, such as Mr. Dilanga, seated there near to you, Honorable Chairperson, will assist us whenever questions come up. But we're here to look at criminal law, forensic procedures amendment bill, and as you said, we don't have enough time, so I'll be short, concise, and straightforward, and hand over to the first presenter, Patricia Whittle. Go ahead.
Thank you, Chairperson, honorable members. This is just a short summary to sort of give some information on how the bill is structured, and what I'm feel are the most important issues that the committee may want to consider when the bill actually comes formally before the committee. I just want to draw members' attention also to the fact that the bill does have a summary on page 24 to 25. So I'm not going to duplicate the summary that is already in the bill, but I'm just going to draw attention to a few selected clauses in the way that they appear or in the order that they appear on the bill. Just for information also, just briefly, if we go to the next slide, on slide 2, just basically setting out how I intend to deal with the presentation. First of all, I'm just going to give a short introduction and then talk a little bit about the structure of the bill. And the important thing there is what the bill actually does, it amends certain acts and the issues that stem from those amendments. And then briefly going to various clauses, clauses 1, 2, 3, and then clause 6, and then the last part of the presentation will be dealing with the consequential amendments in clauses 7 to 10 of the bill. And then just as by way of introduction on the bill, the Criminal Law Forensic Procedures Amendment Bill has been introduced in Parliament to address current gaps in our criminal procedure as far as the taking and collecting of DNA samples and fingerprints are concerned. So there has been a gap that has been identified, and the Department has then introduced this bill to address that issue. So currently, in terms of the Criminal Procedure Act, it only regulates the taking of blood samples in criminal cases and the ascertainment of other bodily features. And currently, what the bill also wants to do is to establish a national database. So when that DNA samples have been collected, it must be stored somewhere. And the situation currently within the police department is that the police only has access to its own database, which stores fingerprints of convicted persons only. And that figure is estimated in the region of more than 6 million fingerprints that the police have access to. And the important information there is its convicted persons' fingerprints that they have. So what the bill then wants to do is, by addressing the gap in the legislation, it wants to expand the powers of the police to collect and store DNA sample and fingerprints, to establish and administer a national DNA database, and also to give the police access to the electronic databases of the Department of Home Affairs, which currently stores 31 million fingerprints of citizens, or the fingerprints of 31 million citizens and approximately 2.5 million foreigners, and also the 6 million or so thumbprints currently being stored by the Department of Transport. So, briefly, then, if you look at the structure of the bill, it can be a bit confusing, but if one looks at how the bill is structured, as I mentioned before, the bill actually amends certain acts, and the important acts that are being amended is the Criminal Procedure Act, the South African Police Service Act, the Firearms Control Act, and the Explosives Act. And in the way that these acts are being dealt with in the bill also explains why the bill is structured like this, because the various clauses actually deal with the actual amendments as they will appear in those acts. So the sections in those acts that are being amended are actually inserted in the bill. And sometimes what members will find is when, for instance, in clause 2, you will see something like section 36A and section 36B and section 36C. So it can be a bit confusing. But just to keep in mind that those are the actual sections of the respective acts that are being amended. So if one then looks at the key issues that we feel that we can bring before the committee for consideration, the preamble obviously sets out the objectives of the bill, and I've mentioned something about what the bill wants to achieve with expanding the powers of the police to be able to take and collect and store DNA samples and fingerprints and the database that they want to establish, and obviously having access to additional databases to expand the number of fingerprints that they can have access to. So that is set out in the preamble. And then from clause 2, it actually starts then with the act that is first being amended, being the Criminal Procedure Act. And what is important in clause 2 is actually the various sections, 36A, 36B, and 36C of the Criminal Procedure Act that are being amended. What is important for the first part is that there are certain definitions that are being inserted into that particular act. And then it also deals with the powers of the police as far as the taking of fingerprints and DNA samples are concerned, and also the storage and the use of those fingerprints. And you will also note that it also speaks about body prints and photographic images of persons. If I move on to slide 5, it speaks about the establishment of the national database. What is important in with regard to the database is that there are different indexes or indices being established, one of them being the crime scene index, the reference index, a convicted offender index, volunteer index, and then have a personnel, contractor, and supplier eliminator index. And then the bill also talks about quality assurance standards with regard to the management of that database, and what happens to those samples, how it must be stored, how long it must be retained, when it can be destroyed, and who can destroy it. And then the use of or the purpose for which DNA samples and profiles can be used, and the bill also then has a built-in penalty if the use of that DNA or fingerprint evidence that's on these databases are used for anything other than detecting a crime or investigating a crime or for prosecution purposes. So anything that is beyond the scope of that, then there will be certain penalties that will be applicable. And then the last part then, as far as the structure of the bill is concerned, then deals with the police having to issue instructions, national instructions, and regulations that have to be drafted by the minister with regard to the database and how the police must exercise their powers that the bill is now giving to them with regard to the collecting, storing, and destruction of DNA samples and profiles. And then the last part of the bill, clauses 7 to 10, are the consequential amendments, we can call it, to the Firearms Control Act and the Explosive Act, because now the scope of the for example, the fingerprint evidence, especially and the DNA samples that has been expanded. So these acts have to be brought in line with the provisions that are now being inserted into the act. So it's consequential amendments to those acts. If I can just briefly touch on the key issues, and I don't want to expand too much on it because my colleague Anne is going to speak more in detail about some issues, but just more for to raise awareness of those issues as they appear in the bill. So when the bill presents itself before the committee, that those issues can be kept in mind when deliberating on the bill. First of all, we mentioned about the expansion of the powers of the police to collect, store, and destroy DNA evidence. And then the issue here is to whom does that the bill then become applicable to? And what is the purpose of DNA and fingerprint evidence? And earlier on I spoke about it has to be for the detection or investigation of a crime or for prosecution purposes. And the bill is very clear about what that purpose is. And then other issues that may also have to be considered is the retention of samples once they have been taken. Should they be retained and whose sample should be retained? For instance, if a person has been found not guilty or is not convicted, should that person's DNA samples or profile still be retained on the database? So those are issues that the committee may want to consider when the bill comes before the committee for consideration. And then something else that will also be discussed in the next presentation concerns that of consent. Because the database, there's also provision for persons to voluntarily submit samples under certain conditions. And then what the bill specifies about that, if there's consent, first of all, if they consent to their samples to be taken and stored. But then there are other provisions that also impact on the retention of those samples, because at some point the bill will say the samples can be retained, and then where the bill refers to the volunteer index is concerned, then the bill also makes a provision that samples must be retained, and in other places it says the samples or the profiles can be destroyed after 5 years. So there has to be some alignment in the bill between, you know, there has to be some kind of certainty about when samples can be destroyed and for how long they need to be retained on the database and whose samples can be stored. Then just to move on to definitions, in clause 2 I mentioned earlier on, we spoke about definitions being inserted, and one definition that I briefly want to touch on is that of authorized person. And the authorized person is, in this instance, refers to who is the person that can take a DNA sample or fingerprint. And what's important in terms of the bill, it says any police official in the performance of his or her official duties. And one thing that we just want to bring to the attention of the committee is there might be a problem with the word any police official, because of the bill also wanting to have some kind of safeguard to ensure the integrity of DNA samples, there may need to be some sanction as to, or qualification as to, what the rank or qualification of that police official needs to be. So that is something that the committee just needs to, may want to consider, whether that should be specified in a different manner. And then moving further on also to definitions is that the bill become applicable to everyone, including children. And in the definitions, you'll find that a child is being defined as a person under 18, so which means that the bill also becomes applicable to children. And then the important thing here is that there is other legislation that deals with the issues of children. So those, the legislation applying to children and how the bill deals with children in this instance also needs to be considered to make sure that there is no clash, that everything is in line as far as that is concerned. And then the DNA or the definition of DNA as it is set out on page 3 of the bill,
I find that maybe this is an area which can be improved somewhat, because if you look at the 6A1D, which is the definition of DNA, is just given as deoxyribonucleic acid. And then obviously the next question is, what is deoxyribonucleic acid? So this is an area that the committee can look at, where the board may want to give more information to sort of clarify what exactly is meant by DNA and what exactly is meant by a DNA profile. And here what I found was a useful explanation of what DNA is on the next slide, slide 9. There was a judgment in December last year in State versus Marple, where it gives a very good explanation of what DNA stands for. And it says that deoxyribonucleic acid is a chemical found in every cell in the body, which carries genetic information from one generation to the next. And it is in the form of a code or language which determines our physical characteristics and directs all the chemical processes in the body. And it also says that everyone's DNA is unique, except for identical twins who will have the same DNA. And then it also explains that we get half our DNA from our mothers and half from our fathers, and it can be extracted from the nucleus of a cell, and then what it includes, blood, semen, saliva, or hair samples. And then the other thing, in terms of the bulk DNA profile, is a result of forensic DNA analysis of an intimate sample, a non-intimate sample, or other bodily substance. And so what then basically then comes down to is that the DNA sample that is taken is analyzed, and then certain information is then derived from that, and the profile is then drawn up, which is then referred to as the DNA profile. So this just being brought to the committee in terms of how the definition scores deal with or set out what these different terms mean, and that there are areas that can be improved as far as that is concerned. As I mentioned earlier, to who the ball becomes applicable to. And then obviously, I spoke a little bit earlier also about what is the purpose of DNA, and what the penalties are if it is used for any other purpose than what is set out in the ball. And then moving on to the next slide, slide 12. We still, with clause 2, just for information, as I mentioned earlier on, clause 2 actually deals with actual sections in the Criminal Procedure Act that will be amended. So section 36C is still a section within the Criminal Procedure Act that deals with fingerprints, body prints, and non-intimate samples of a person or group of persons, and that is to be found on page 5 of the bill. And what is important here is the police official can take these samples without a warrant if there are reasonable grounds to suspect that an offence has been committed. And then I think one of the questions that came up previously before the ADA committee was also around reasonable grounds. The committee may want to consider whether there should be a set of requirements to set out what would constitute reasonable grounds, or whether it should be left open to interpretation. And then what and also is being dealt with under this clause is that there can be a speculative search that can be done on samples that have been taken, and then the person who has control over the prints or samples can examine the sample. And I think this is one area where there needs to be a little bit more clarity, because I'm not sure if a police official who takes the sample will examine it, because I thought that would be the job of the forensics analyst. So just where the ball is not clear on who exactly does what, there has to be more distinction and consistency between the persons who collect the DNA, who handle the DNA, who transport the DNA, who store, who analyze, and who compile the DNA protocols. And I think those are distinctive functions, and it would assist greatly to bring certainty if those things are clearly set out in the bill. Moving on to the next slide. Clause 3 on page 6 of the bill amends section 57 of the Criminal Procedure Act, which deals with body prints, photographic images, intimate and non-intimate samples. And earlier on, I mentioned that on the issue of reasonable grounds, up to now, we've seen that the police official was the person who needed to have to believe that there were reasonable grounds that the samples will assist in the detection or investigation of the crime. But now we talk about the medical practitioner, the taking of an intimate sample. What the bill does is it differentiates between intimate and a non-intimate sample. So if an intimate sample is taken, for instance, if blood is taken from anywhere but the finger, then it becomes an intimate sample. So that means a medical practitioner must take that sample. But what the bill then does in section 37.2b, it says that the medical practitioner must have reasonable grounds to suspect that some it may assist in investigation of the crime or that an offence has been committed. And I think that that reference to medical practitioner should rather refer to the police official, because I believe that the medical practitioner's job is to take the sample and not do with anything to do with investigation itself. And then just other things maybe in this clause that may be considered is are the circumstances or should circumstances be set out in the bill when the police official will not be authorized to take certain samples. And then the destruction of print samples and information after 5 years where there is no conviction, that there should be more certainty around that. On slide 14, dealing with clause 6 of the bill, which inserts chapter 5A into the South African Police Services Act regarding the storage and use of fingerprints, body prints, and photographic images. I mentioned earlier on that there will be speculative searching and cross-checking of prints and images that SAT will be able to do with the fingerprints and information they already have on their database with that of other departments like the Department of Transport and the Department of Home Affairs. And then what this section also does is it sets out that the National Police Commissioner must issue national instructions and develop training courses with regard to the storage and use of fingerprints, body prints, and photographic images. The important issue with regard to the national instructions is that there's a bold differentiates between national instructions referring to DNA evidence and national instructions referring to fingerprints, body prints, and photographic images. So in the instance of DNA evidence, only that national instructions are required to be tabled in Parliament. And what we want to bring before the committee is the question whether all the national instructions should be tabled in Parliament, or whether it is sufficient that only that specific instructions dealing with DNA evidence is tabled in Parliament. And another question is also, should it rather refer to regulations, which must then be tabled and approved by Parliament? Or is that in addition to regulations and national instructions, and which must be tabled in Parliament? Moving on to slide 15. This is something to do with the location of the national database, and I'm not going to expand too much on that except to say that the responsibilities under Section 15C set out in such a way that the Divisional Commissioner of the Criminal Record and Forensic Science Services is the person who has authority to carry out those responsibilities. And it was the ad hoc committee who dealt with this call previously was informed that the police wanted to provide, or the department wanted to provide, a certain level of independence and accountability for the database apart from the police. And the question then is, is it envisaged that there will be a full, autonomous, separate structure that is not located under the police? And if it is not possible to do it now, is it envisaged in the future? And what are we looking at in terms of time frames for that to happen? And then the bill also sets out as part of its objectives to have some sort of safeguards and measures and accountability. And what we would like the committee to consider is whether the measures that are already in the bill, whether these are sufficient, and are there areas in which they maybe can be expanded or improved. And then more information is needed on the National Police Commissioner's responsibility to develop, implement, and maintain a personal identification services strategy to give effect to Chapters 5A and 5B. So the bill doesn't really say clearly what is meant by what is a personal identification service strategy. Then moving on to slide 16, we start with clause 6 of the bill. And now we have a Chapter 5B that is being inserted into the South African Police Services Act, which deals with establishment and administration and the maintenance of the National DNA Database. And I'm not going to, I've already said something about the database, so I'm not going to repeat that information. But just again to consider, if a person has given consent for DNA sample to be stored on the database, can that person be allowed to withdraw that consent? Because currently what the bill is saying is that a person who's given consent cannot withdraw consent. And I think the question is why it is voluntary. Why can that consent not be withdrawn? So just in terms of what the department wants to achieve in this clause, if maybe that is clarified more, then there may be just a way of phrasing that slightly different to bring out the intention of what the department really wants to achieve under this. And then obviously also looking at the period of the bill talks about the retention of profile for 5 years. And then also is that 5 years, what informs the 5 years? Or should something else that may be considered, whether there shouldn't be any time frame, whether samples or profiles can be stored indefinitely on any database. Moving on to slide number 18. Just something that I mentioned earlier on, where the bill establishes the different indices, and one in particular is that of the personnel, contractor, and supplier elimination index, which will store profiles of, example, police officers or forensics staff, I would imagine, for exclusion purposes. I think what is important to note here is that it would appear as if the bill, as if a person whose information appears on that index are automatically excluded from being a suspect or from being on a particular crime scene. And I think the question here is that whether that should be an automatic process or whether there should be, rather the bill should rather set out an elimination process, just to be sure that no one is overlooked just because you're a staff member who may have been in contact with a crime scene, but that the normal that there should be a more of a safeguard where that is concerned. Then in this chapter also, it makes provision for the profiles of DNA in the National Database of South Africa to be compared with other countries and for comparison purposes, and what information can be divulged or shared between countries in this regard. Slide 19, as I mentioned before, talks about consequential amendments to the Firearms Control Act and the Explosive Act. Just to mention briefly, on the Firearms Control Act, it makes provision for the fingerprints that must accompany applications for company certificates, licenses, or permits, and where it must be stored, and it also talks about who can take it, and any police official can take it, and where the Firearms Control Act, it will then be to determine whether a person has handled or discharged a firearm. And then consequently, in the Explosive Act, it will what will apply is if it is suspected that someone has committed a crime, it would be to determine whether a person has handled or detonated an explosive. So basically, in these two, where these two acts are concerned, we see that provision is made for a registered medical practitioner or nurse to take intimate samples from suspects or persons who apply in terms of make application in terms of these acts. Then, Chairperson, just by way of conclusion, as I've mentioned before, the bill addresses or wants to address certain gaps in our legislation. But what we also want to bring before the committee is that we're looking at the practical implications of what is going to be required to achieve the objectives of the bill. And especially as far as the police are concerned, there's going to be a need to have the proper forensics experts training equipment and facilities in place before the bill comes into operation in order to achieve the objectives of the bill. When the ADA committee visited the forensics labs in January of this year, the presentation that was given to us is that there is a challenge with regard to retaining and attracting forensics experts. And then even now in March 2009, the Auditor General audit of the service delivery at 10111 and police stations have shown that there's a lack or there's a gap with regard to training of police officials that with regard to the basic training, for instance, like statement taking, there's a in two stations they found that 100% of the staff have not attended that basic training. So what we want to then place before the committee is that when I spoke earlier on also about the level of skill that's going to be required from people who handle the DNA, because what is going to happen is going to increase the administrative load on police officials. It's going to increase the time that they're going to spend with persons, DNA, again, because it's going to apply to all arrested persons, even persons who've been arrested on minor traffic offences. So there's going to be an increase in administrative load, so it's going to even be more important that the level of skill is there so that there's no mix-up. Because if the integrity of a sample is not protected, then it will mean it will impact on another person's life, which could then be, it's the difference between guilty and not guilty. And that is where the safeguard in the bill is actually going to be achieved in bringing that measures, setting out exactly what the police can and cannot do. And also what we found in the bill is that the person, for instance, who refuses or feels they have good reason to refuse the taking of a sample, there's no remedy set out for that person. And I think there can be maybe a little bit more of a balance to protect the individual's rights under certain circumstances. So there should be greater safeguards, and then the shortage of forensics personnel. The presentation that we received from the lab at the time was that even with the incentives of higher salaries and care skills allowances, it did not really bring about the desired change in curbing the exit of forensic experts. And it also didn't help to attract more forensic personnel into the lab at the rate that will be required. And one of the problems that were given at the time was that the entry level was very low. And so the people who may have had the necessary skills are not drawn to want to apply to such a course at the entry level. And one proposal, if I may, Chairperson, I want to maybe bring before the committee that and maybe bring before the department is currently what they also said was that forensic experts in South Africa are very much in demand elsewhere in the world because of the wide variety of experience they get in their career span. And maybe one of the things that the department may want to consider is an internship program to attract overseas forensic personnel to South Africa to gain the necessary experience here, who can then play a mentoring role. So they will have the competency level and the proficiency level as far as the academic and experiences are concerned, but with South Africa giving them, for instance, exposure to situations that they will not may not necessarily experience elsewhere. And then we've been informed that the department will do a presentation on the costing of the bill. At the time, earlier on in this year, they said it was between 8 and 9 billion rand. And so the department had to give a clear setting out of that business plan that they talked about and how they're going to bring about the desired infrastructure, personnel, and facilities to bring about the objects of the bill. And then just to also conclude that the use of DNA evidence will enhance the police's crime-fighting capabilities. That cannot be denied. But we're also saying that there must be the safeguards and the constitutional requirements must be considered in terms of the bill and other legislative provisions like the Promotion of Administrative Justice Act, the Access of Information Act, and obviously the Constitution, which will be applicable. And it's only when we have a balanced act and especially if a lot of consideration has been given on the implementation side of, then this act can really be a very strong and useful crime fighting tool. Thank you, Chairperson.
Chairperson, perhaps what should have been said during my introduction is that some of these presentations will overlap in terms of identifying the issues and also the emphasis that they'll place on certain issues. And what has been said by Patricia is likely to come up in Suen's presentation and also in my presentation. But that is not a trend smash. It's not a bad thing because here we are just sharing information. This is an information sharing session. So if you hear the same thing more than once, it means one, it's reliable, and two, it's valid, and therefore it's good for you. Yeah. What I want to request, Jefferson, due to the time pressure that we have, is that we allow Suen to proceed with her presentation, and perhaps after her presentation, we can try to look at the questions, if there are any. And I would like to also highlight that what is in the presentation is also distributed, Jeremy, in the handouts. There are documents that are written on this. So members do have those. Okay, so, right.
Well, good afternoon to the chairperson and members again. My presentation today is going to deal with issues that the committee may wish to consider when deliberating on the bill. And the second part of my presentation deals with comparative issues, looking at other countries, how do they deal with forensic evidence. Now, the bill is quite technical in nature, and I'm going to try to be as simple as possible to try to explain these matters, and some of them may overlap with previous presentation.
The issues that I wish to highlight are issues that came about from the deliberations of the ad hoc committee, from public submissions, and further from our own analysis of the bill. The first issue, and in general when passing legislation, the committee needs to consider the constitutionality of the bill. Various rights may be infringed by the bill. These include the right to equality, privacy, human dignity, bodily integrity, children, and accused persons. Now, to do a complete constitutional analysis will take quite some time, so I'm just going to highlight certain issues here, and while they arise in other matters, I will also draw your attention to that. The bill needs to comply with the provisions of the Bill of Rights. So basically, if a right is being infringed by the bill, the committee needs to consider whether this infringement is justifiable in terms of the limitations clause. With regard to the right to privacy, this is the right that will come up most often as being the one that's infringed by the bill. So basically, what is the right to privacy? In this instance, we are talking about genetic information, about DNA and fingerprints. So the committee needs to consider whether the limitation of a person's right to privacy regarding their genetic information, So the committee needs to consider the rights regarding genetic information and fingerprints. Regarding the right to equality, the bill does not differentiate, deals with arrested people, people who are acquitted of in trials, and differentiates between those people and ordinary citizens. So regarding that, is the right to equality infringed, and is this a reasonable violation of the right? The right to human dignity and bodily integrity as well. Both of these rights are infringed, and the committee needs to consider whether this infringement is reasonable. With regard specifically to the rights of convicted persons, the right to privacy being infringed in this regard. Now, it can be argued that people who have committed an offense and have been convicted in a court of law, it is reasonable to limit their rights. Society would expect that the state keeps information of convicted people because there is a very great chance that these people may reoffend, and this information will be used in further investigations and detection of future crimes. So there may be a justifiable limitation on the rights of convicted persons. With regards to the rights of privacy of arrested people, now this is a more difficult issue. When a person is arrested, the state may have a legitimate reason to take their fingerprints and DNA samples due to the investigation of the offense. But in instances where charges are withdrawn against the person, where a person goes to trial and is found not guilty, the bill still allows for this information to be retained. So is this a justifiable limitation, for example, in the right to a person who has been found not guilty? What is the reason for retaining this information? With regard to a person where charges have been withdrawn, again, what is the reason for retaining this information? Why should this person be treated differently from an ordinary citizen who has no criminal charges against him? So these are the issues that the committee may want to consider. And secondly, the bill deals with convicted people and arrested people. But in these two categories, there's different subcategories. So there's convicted people who committed serious offenses and convicted people who've committed minor offenses. Should these two categories of people be treated the same? And with regard to arrested people, there's people who have been acquitted, who've gone through the criminal process and been found not guilty. Should they be treated the same as people who have charges pending against them or people who have charges withdrawn against them? So we cannot just group the two people as convicted and arrested. We need to differentiate between the subcategories to make sure that there's different rights applicable and there's different limitations that may be justified between the subcategories. grouping them together does not may result in certain subcategory of people's rights being infringed. The next issue that I want to deal with is, very briefly, is fingerprints and DNA samples. Now, I'm not a scientist, I'm a lawyer, so I'm just going to try to give you a brief explanation as to how I understand it. If you look at your fingerprints, it's something that's visible to the naked eye. In order to compare, to identify whether a person is the offender, all that's required is two fingerprint charts, and there's certain points that need to be compared to identify this as a positive match. However, with regard to a DNA sample, this is a sample that is either your blood sample or a tissue sample. Now, the information contained in the sample is not known even to yourself. It needs to be analyzed, and the information contained in it will only come through scientific testing. So the bill equates fingerprints and DNA samples as the same thing. But while a fingerprint may be visible, the DNA sample may be something that requires more privacy protection because you yourself don't know what's contained in the your genetic information. So when we consider this, we need to look at these as two separate categories and ask ourselves, should one category receive more protection than the other category? And that's basically the structure of the DNA, just to show the committee a physical representation. Your fingerprint is what you see, and the DNA structure is something that needs to be analyzed. Getting into the more technical aspects of the bill. The bill does not differentiate between offenses. So a police officer is required to take fingerprints and DNA samples for every offense. So basically, if a person is charged with murder or rape, and a person is charged with an offense such as criminaluria or public urination, then a police officer is required to take samples from all people. Now, if you can imagine how many people are arrested per year, and what's going to happen in terms of analyzing these samples. Is this sort of provision going to create great amounts of backlog? And will there be a differentiation between samples taken to investigate a crime and that is required for trial purposes? So, for example, if the sample is taken to assist in to prosecute a person, will that be given priority over a sample taken from a person who's charged with criminaluria and is merely required for the DNA database? We don't want to create a situation where there's so many samples taken and the forensic labs cannot deal with this, and there's going to be great amounts of backlog, and the result, instead of assisting the police to finalize matters, is going to slow down trials and slow down the whole court processes. With regard to retention of fingerprints for 5 years, as I said previously, accused persons, people who are accused of an offense, examples, and the DNA profile is retained for a period of 5 years. Now, this happens even if the person is not convicted of a crime, and if the charges are withdrawn against the person. And as I've highlighted, this raises constitutional issues about whether this is a legitimate infringement of the right to privacy, and how will the state justify this limitation? Point 5, DNA samples and fingerprints are taken from all arrested people. And as I've just said, they don't differentiate between different offenses. So profiles and samples are retained regardless of the offense. Now, the period of retention in the bill is 5 years. So what we need to ask ourselves is, what is the basis of 5 years? What is it linked to? Do people will reoffend within 5 years? What is the basis of this? In the United Kingdom, they differentiate between the seriousness of the offenses. So So offences which are not so serious are retained for 6 years, while offences which are of a violent nature are retained for 12 years. So treating all offences the same may not, you know, meet the aims of the bill. Certain offences have greater propensity to reoccur. So sexual offences may be more recidivist in nature than other minor offences. So that's something the committee may want to consider, differentiating between minor offences, which people really don't recommit, and against serious offences, there's a greater degree of recidivism. Dealing with destruction of fingerprints on slide six, the information derived from the samples of from the DNA samples must be destroyed after 5 years. However, there seems to be a little difference between what is said in the Criminal Procedure Amendment and the amendment to the South African Police Act. While the Criminal Procedure Act speaks about samples being destroyed after 5 years, the amendment to the Police Act says that no DNA profile loaded onto the database may be destroyed. But it provides a qualification to this, saying that bodily substances or intimate samples may be destroyed after 5 years. So the Criminal Procedure Act amendment says that samples must be destroyed, samples and profiles of people who have been arrested but not subsequently convicted must be destroyed after 5 years. But the Police Act does not specify that profiles must be destroyed. So there needs to be clarity as to why profiles of people who have been arrested and not subsequently convicted is not specified. Further, in terms of the section, it speaks about samples, bodily substances and not intimate substances shall be destroyed. In terms of legislative drafting and plain English usage, the word shall is not really does not really give clarity. It would be better if the bill uses the word may or must, so we would know whether the destruction is compulsory. So in terms of, it would be more clear in that regard. The further issue is the mandatory retention of DNA samples. Now, for all, in terms of the bill, for all people who are convicted, the samples will be retained indefinitely, and for people who are accused, the samples will be retained after 5 years. Now, during the deliberations of the ad hoc committee, issues were raised about capacity constraints. Does the South African police have enough resources to retain samples indefinitely, especially for convicted persons? They would need, they may need specialized storage facilities, and there's resource constraints. So the committee was considering the issue as to whether samples should be retained indefinitely. The next issue that I'm dealing with is child offenders. Now, the bill does not differentiate between adult offenders and child offenders. And is this in line with the direction that our law is moving into, where children are treated differently from adult offenders? South Africa also has obligations in terms of international law, and our own Child Justice Act creates a specific sort of regime to deal with children. So the bill is not in line with this. For example, it says that the profiles of convicted children will be retained indefinitely, while the Child Justice Act creates provisions where children who have convictions against names can apply for these records to be expunged. So these two are not correlating, and the committee may want to consider whether they should be a different, whether children should be treated differently from adults. With regard to body prints, the Act has a specific, the bill has a specific definition of body prints, which does not include a lot of other things. During the deliberations, the National Prosecution Authority felt that this definition was not broad enough. So they felt that this should be extended to include further technological advances. So, for example, the definition doesn't cover iris scanning that may come in future. So maybe the committee may want to just extend the definition to state that this includes any other part of the body. With regard to the using force to obtain evidence, now previously when the police used force to obtain evidence, the present law is that this evidence is not inadmissible in a court of law. This evidence related to accused persons. So if an accused person resisted assisting the police in getting the DNA sample or fingerprints, the police officer could use force to get that, and the court will not automatically exclude the evidence. Now there's an amendment to this bill, to the act, which says that it no longer applies only to accused people, but to all persons. So if a bystander, for example, refuses to give evidence, can the police officer use force and take evidence? Those are issues that the committee may want to consider and raise with the department. During the deliberations of the ad hoc committee, the South African Human Rights Commission objected to this amendment, saying that it gave the police carte blanche to obtain samples and evidence. The next point deals with volunteers. As my colleague had highlighted previously, once a person consents as a volunteer, they cannot have the information removed from the DNA database. The question is, what is the reason for this? If you are volunteering your DNA to assist in an investigation, why does the police have the right to retain your information? What is the basis for this retention? And secondly, the bill talks about informed consent. So a volunteer must give the informed consent. But in a situation, in a country like South Africa, where people speak various languages, where they may not understand the implications of giving a DNA sample, when is consent informed? Will people understand the implications of giving a sample? Will the police explain it to them adequately? So that's something we need to consider. A further issue that needs to be considered is that parents are given the right to consent to give a DNA sample of their children. Upon reaching the age of majority, a child can apply to court to have that sample removed. This is dealing with children volunteers. So if the police needs assistance with an investigation and the parent agrees to volunteer the child's sample, at the age of 18, the child can apply to court to have the sample removed. Now, this creates a very high burden on the child, because at the age of 18, they would have to engage a lawyer to go to court and have the sample removed. So why does the bill place the onus on the child, and why isn't there an automatic removal of the DNA profile and sample at the age of 18? So that's something that the committee may want to consider. Another issue is expungement. Basically, expungement means that you ask for your DNA profile to be removed from the DNA database. Now, the bill does not provide any procedure for this. So what is the purpose of having a sort of procedure? For instance, if a person is incorrectly identified, or their profile is included by error on the database, or later it was found out that the police had illegally arrested them, what procedure is there for them to have their DNA profile removed from the database? At present, the bill does not deal with this instance. Another issue that I just would like to highlight is that when people speak about matches on the DNA database and actual conviction rates, a match in the DNA database basically means that DNA found on a crime scene matches a profile contained on the database. That means a person whose profile is matched was present at the crime scene. It does not mean that person is the perpetrator of the offense. So when you hear people talking about matches between the DNA database and the crime scene, please, you know, bear in mind this does not necessarily mean that this person is the perpetrator. At present, it's difficult to get what the actual conviction rates are from these matches. So that's just something for the committee to bear in mind. During the deliberations of the ad hoc committee, the issue was raised as to whether considering all the constitutional implications, should the DNA database should be extended to include every South African? So in terms of the scenario, either at birth or at the age of 16, every South African will give a DNA sample and this will be stored in a database. So every South African will be treated equally. Now, in considering this, firstly, this does not take away the constitutional issues. Instead, it raises more issues about genetic privacy. Should the state be storing information about every citizen on the possibility that they may in the future commit an offense? Secondly, the cost implications of this, I mean, to store the DNA and to profile the DNA of every single citizen is going to be extremely expensive. If you look at the United Kingdom, which has one of the leading databases at present, despite all the resources, only 7.39% of its population is on the DNA database. And for a country like the United States, only 0.5% of its population is on the DNA database. So in terms of resources in itself, it will be very difficult for every single South African citizen to have their profile on the DNA database. Excuse me. With regard to the implementation plan, as my colleague highlighted, and I'm just going to be brief on this, during the deliberations of the ad hoc committee, questions were raised about the implementation plan. While the aim of the bill is to assist police in investigations and increasing conviction rates, how is this bill going to be implemented? So the committee may want to consider the implementation plan to ensure that this legislation is effective. It's no point us passing legislation when in practice it's not being put into effect. Further, as my colleague also spoke about the cost implications, is the bill going to be adequately funded to deal with, for example, the fact that there needs to be sample kits, there needs to be postage, there needs to be storage facilities? Are all these issues being considered, and is there going to be adequate resources given to the police to deal with it? Again, training police officials quickly. If the police officials are not adequately trained, then every good intention of the drafters and the committee and parliament will not be met, because they are the key persons in dealing with this. If they do not know how to take DNA samples properly and there's contamination, it's going to result in unnecessary cost and result in the bill not being effective. Again, regulations to be approved by Parliament. The other committee had an issue as to whether the National Commission should issue instructions as opposed to there being regulations. I think the committee was more inclined for regulations to be introduced to Parliament and approved, as opposed to the Commissioner be given power to issue national instructions. Dealing with number 19, sharing of information with foreign law enforcement agencies. Now, the bill allows information to be shared, but is there adequate protection of citizens' rights? So if information is sent to another country, what protection of privacy rights are there? The privacy bill, the protection of personal information bill, is presently being deliberated on. So are we going to have any safeguards to ensure that when information is sent to a foreign country, that once it's in that country, it will receive the same protection that it will receive in South Africa? And lastly, regarding safeguards and quality assurance, human error could creep in at all stages of a DNA analysis. So it's therefore very important that there's adequate safeguards and quality assurance. For example, in the UK, they have an independent body that assists in giving advice about safeguards regarding DNA, and my colleague will elaborate further on that. Sorry, just please. The second part of my analysis is a comparative, and I'm going to try to be as brief as possible to look at how other countries deal with forensic evidence. The leading database is the United Kingdom, and the largest database in terms of numbers is the United States. So in terms of the United Kingdom, from whom must the sample be taken? At present, the law allows for all arrested and convicted persons. And the United States, it also allows for arrested and convicted persons. Canada has a very specific procedure where, in order to get this sort of evidence, a DNA warrant must be issued by the court. So in terms of the South African bill, it's in line with the UK and Canada, where we're taking DNA samples from arrested and convicted persons. With regard to, sorry, that should be the retention of DNA profiles from convicted persons, at present, the United Kingdom profiles all convicted persons, and this information is stored indefinitely. This is similar to the bill, which does the same thing, where all convicted persons have their profiles stored indefinitely. The United States is quite different because they have 50 states, and each state has its own law. But in general, 47 states store the profiles of offenders convicted of felonies. Now, felonies are serious crimes compared to serious offenses. And 37 states store the DNA of certain sex crime misdemeanors. These are minor offenses related to sex crime. And 4 states store the DNA of minor offenses. So South Africa is more in line with the United Kingdom in this regard. With regard to the retention of DNA samples, the United States depends on each state according to the law of the state. In the United Kingdom at present, they have an indefinite retention policy, so all DNA samples are stored indefinitely. However, last year, this was challenged in both the House of Lords and later in the European Court of Human Rights. And while the House of Lords found that storing a DNA sample was a reasonable infringement on the right to privacy, this was overturned by the European Court of Human Rights, which found that keeping of samples indefinitely infringed people's rights. The persons in these matters were people who were accused of offenses but were not convicted. The court found that this was an unreasonable infringement of their rights, and as a result of the Marpet judgment, the United Kingdom is presently considering its entire laws regarding DNA. And the proposal regarding the retention of DNA samples is that the samples will be destroyed as soon as an analysis is done. So that's a huge difference from the present, which is indefinite retention, to now really suggesting that as soon as the person is arrested and a sample is taken and analyzed, there's no need to store it anymore. It will be destroyed within a period of 6 months. So that's something the committee may take into consideration. With regard to the European Union states, they have much more stricter retention policies. Most states have either no or limited retention. And it's further highlighted in my paper, so the members can just read the details of this. With regard to detention of profiles of persons who were not convicted of an offense, okay, as previously, when a person was arrested in the United Kingdom, regardless of whether they were subsequently convicted the charges were withdrawn against them or they were acquitted, their profiles were retained indefinitely. Now, in light of the Mafia judgment, the state is reconsidering this, and the proposal is that people who are charged with serious offenses will have their profiles retained for 6 years, and people who are charged with for less serious offenses will have the profiles retained for 6 years, and those charged with much more serious offenses, such as those of a violent nature, a sexual offense, or something related to terrorism, will have their profiles retained for 12 years. So this is basically the proposal. The United States also retains the profiles of people who are arrested but not convicted. However, they have, at federal level, the FBI has specific expungement procedure. So while a person is arrested and has their profile retained, they can, after being found not guilty in a court or if the charges are withdrawn against them, they can apply to the FBI and ask that their profile be removed from the national database. So this is something that our world does not have. the EU states either have no or limited detention. With regard to the treatment of children, the USA in 32 states retain the profile of convicted juveniles, while in the UK, profiles of ensembles are presently retained indefinitely. As I said, the suggestion from the UK is that samples will no longer be retained. And with regard to children, they have proposed that children charged with minor offences will have their records expunged at the age of 18. So our bill does not treat children differently from adult offenders. With regard to expungement of records, the United States has detailed expungement records, and the United Kingdom at present has no expungement procedure. However, at present, the proposal is that they will include expungement procedures in the bill. There will be automatic expungement in certain instances, such as an instance where a person is wrongly identified or there is no offense committed. With regard to volunteers, at present, a volunteer's profile is retained indefinitely in the United Kingdom. However, they have now proposed that volunteers will no longer be included on the DNA database. That in comparison to the bill, this is quite different because the bill at present says that once a person consents, the profile will be retained indefinitely. With regard to foreign access to DNA profiles, the United Kingdom also has concerns over data protection, and they have made strict recommendations in regards to this. The European Union has strict data protection laws, which ensures that information shared with other countries receive adequate protection. With regard to DNA data banks, the United States has a very different system, but in general, the South African DNA data, the different indexes is in line with international trends. In conclusion, I know there's a lot of information that I've just spoken about right now, and it's all detailed in the papers given to the committee in the past. But in summary, I think when considering the bill, the three issues that the committee needs to consider is firstly the constitutionality of the bill with regard to each group of people. Secondly, the implementation of the bill. Is the implementation going to be effective? Is the investment in resources going to result in tangible results? And thirdly, is the cost implication, which is the bill going to be adequately funded to ensure that it meets the requirements?
Thanks. Moving on and moving along. Where are we now? Closer. Then the next presentation. Actually, my colleagues here have said quite a lot, and in fact, they've covered almost everything. So what we're going to have now is just a short, summary of everything that has been said, but also emphasizing on the important issues that the committee will have to consider when it begins looking at the bill. The issues of storage of DNA samples have been mentioned, the misuse, but what I'll focus more on is the location of the crime labs, the laboratories that will be analyzing this information. Then we also highlight the safeguards and look at the division within the SAPS that is dealing with the task of DNA fingerprinting, and then raise the concerns that the previous committee, ad hoc committee, raised and also looked at, particularly during the trip that it took to Pretoria in January, early this year. These are the terms that we've had today: DNA profiling, DNA typing, DNA fingerprinting, or genetic fingerprinting. Sometimes they are used interchangeably, but they could also mean different things, like DNA profiling may not be the same as DNA fingerprinting. But anyway, what we know is that this bill seeks to enhance the investigative capacity of the SAPS, and it is very important in our fight against crime as a nation. So there is no doubt about that. And the usefulness of DNA fingerprinting, as I prefer calling it, it may help in exonerating innocent individuals who may be charged wrongfully for crimes. And it also helps in bringing those who are responsible for crimes to justice. And it is widely supported for its positive use in the criminal justice system. And as I've said, it will enhance the SAPS capability in the fight against crime. And one of the good things about it, as my colleagues have said, is that DNA, every one of us has DNA. And if these samples are stored, it creates a stronger likelihood for anyone who commits a crime to be detected easily. So once there is that notion that if I commit a crime, the probability of me being caught is high, people will refrain. And that is the logic in crime deterrence, that if one knows that if I do this, I might be caught, or the likelihood is that it's high, I'll be caught, then people will refrain. However, the concern that has been raised, the constitutionality and the way the bill might infringe on civil liberties, is one thing that the committee will have to look at extensively. The methodology of DNA fingerprinting, its necessity, its application or procedures, the way it's used, or the way samples are taken or utilized or stored, including the duration of storage, one of the things that will have to be considered. And also, should this be raised against the state in the court of law, the state bears the onus to justify itself in using its methodology and the way it stored the samples, which I believe all those will be clarified when the bill is being processed. The duration of DNA storage has been highlighted as one of the issues that the committee will have to look at, whether it has to be kept for a long time or for a short period of time or indefinitely. The committee will have to discuss that and deliberate on that and come up with what will work for the nation, and also keeping in mind what is at stake. We want to win the fight against crime, and if this bill is essential in that regard, therefore a valid reason must be presented as to why we need to have a well-endowed database that can be maintained for a long period of time in order to ensure that there's a high probability of getting criminals, because that is the main objective, eventually. So, as I say, a well-endowed database may act as a deterrent, and some countries keep it indefinitely. However, maintaining a database is expensive, and retaining DNA profiles and samples indefinitely means extra cost. And we did see in one of the previous presentations that the estimate that the department came up with in terms of implementing this bill is about $9 billion. Now, do we have that extra amount of money to be channeled towards the implementation of this particular legislation? It comes with costs, as crime is costing us. Concerns regarding the misuse of DNA, one of the issues is fraud, and the other one regards the incompetence of those who will be tasked with handling the DNA samples, either taking them or analyzing them. The issue of fraud needs to be looked at carefully, because we know that law enforcement agencies throughout the world are marred by corruption in one way or the other, and the South African Police Service as well is known to be one of the law enforcement agencies that is regarded as corrupt. So that is where we will need strong and serious safeguards to ensure that the issues such as fraudulent activities do not come up. cops have powers that normal citizens do not have, and when they investigate, they can even place evidence that that's to link someone to a crime, and those are the things that may be fraudulent in nature, which you may find that innocent people end up being convicted based on this DNA evidence, which has been fraudulently, manipulated. So, safeguards again come up. We need to ensure that we have competent people who are dealing with these things, and also issues of corruption and fraud are eliminated, so that we can maintain and harness the integrity of our criminal justice system. And as I've said, this act may lead to wrongful conviction. And forensic experts do argue that there is no such thing as an error-free database. Now, if people are dealing with this thing on a daily basis, attest to the fact that there's nothing such as a data-free, there's nothing such as an error-free database. That means there is a level of mishap that may happen. And to ensure that that doesn't happen is through having rigorous safeguards. And that is one of the things that the committee will have to look at when deliberating on this matter. I have said, and my colleagues have also indicated, that DNA provides insight into personal aspects of individuals and families regarding illnesses and diseases, and these need to be handled with care, as they may infringe into civil liberties. If this information is not protected adequately, then the government will be interfering with the individual's rights to privacy and life. And there is fear that stored information can be misused, as I've said, or exploited. And the government should guard these rights within the framework of the law, as the committee will make the law. When looking at the issue of location of crime labs, some say in order to prevent these fraudulent activities which I've just highlighted, which may be committed by police, such as placing of evidence and all those things, we need to have crime labs in the private sector. They need to be privatized. And people do raise strong arguments in this regard. Probably, maybe because there are reasons for this, or maybe for personal reasons. I'm not sure, but they do raise these things, and all arguments that come up need to be looked at and be taken into consideration. It is said that private labs will enhance competition, and private labs will compete with each other, thereby raising their performance standards. And it is said, when crime labs are under the state or located within the police department, there's an issue of monopoly. And one expert says that a crime lab that functions within the police department is a monopoly of the evidence. Such monopoly allows it to conduct sloppy, biased, and even fraudulent work. No other lab is likely to examine the same evidence as it is monopolized by the state crime lab, which raises questions about transparency and accountability. The other issue is dependence, that crime labs located within the police department depend heavily on police budgets, which is likely to lead to bias and misuse of DNA samples and profiles. Such dependence creates no pro-prosecution bias. The third issue is the poor quality control, that for crime labs located within police departments, quality control tends to be weak, which undermines the integrity of the work produced by the lab. And these are the things that have been said by researchers throughout the world and people who have vested interest in these matters.
And the committee does have, I mean, need to look at this, I mean, these issues more seriously and then weigh them and see which one works best for us as a nation and South Africa. The power of forensic worker is one last issue that is raised. That the police forensic worker is an autonomous authority with power. The power of such a forensic worker operating in a poorly controlled environment without checks and balances can lead to substandard forensics. So the argument here is that in order to eliminate all these negative aspects is to privatize the issue of DNA fingerprinting. It's one of the suggestions that I made. But also there's an argument against private labs, that private labs have a tendency to give lawyers the results they want to hear, as such practice may lead or may be good for business. So in this case, private labs are not only accessed by prosecutors or investigators, but even private lawyers or anyone can access them. And in these businesses, money talks. So in order to eliminate all those things, whether we agree as a nation to have these labs within the police department or privatize them or whatever, safeguards need to be there. Quality assurance needs to be primary, and good laboratory practice has to be ensured. Need to make use of quality standards management, that, I mean, standards that are accepted throughout the world, international standards. And those quality management standards should ensure compliance with the international standards, as I've said, and also ensure proper practice and the procedures. Ensure that proper practice and procedures are followed. And the calibration of machines is one of the things, or one of the safeguards that needs to be there. Now, in South Africa currently, who is dealing or who will be dealing with this mammoth task of DNA fingerprinting? We have in the division, I mean in the SAPS division, called the Criminal Records and Forensic Science Services, which has three units: the Criminal Records Center, the Forensic Laboratory, Science Laboratory, Technology and Technical Management. At the time when the committee visited this division in January this year, there were about 4,557 members and staff complement for this division. However, we were told that there's a high rate of turnover, and they were losing about 10 to 15 members a month. I don't know whether that's an exaggeration, because if that is the case, it would mean by now they don't have anyone. But as my colleague once mentioned earlier, that issues of levels of entry were matters that were being looked at in order to retain the staff. Probably department, when it comes here, it can be interrogated as to how they looked at the issue of retention. And throughout the country, we have 91 local criminal record centers, which store original fingerprints of more than 6 million convicted persons. This unit receives more than a million requests a year. Fingerprint verification is done electronically on AFIS, which unfortunately is not linked to HANIS, or the one that was given from traffic, which the bill wants to... Yeah, all those. The bill wants to put this together so that they can assist one another when DNA fingerprinting is being conducted. Other requests for fingerprint verification are for firearm licenses and security clearances, which also adds on the burden that this unit already has in focusing on fingerprint verification for criminal aspects. The budget, as we have said, that this will cost a lot in when it's being implemented. For this year, the CRC received 696 million, and the FSL, which is the
forensic sciences laboratory received from 98 million, which means when the bill is being fully implemented, we will have to see a big jump on this allocation so that it can be feasible to actually, you know, implement it. The bulk of the FSL activities currently consist of ballistics and biology services, and its chemistry section deals with toxicology and drug analysis. The challenges, again, for the forensic science laboratory is the shortage of personnel, as we have indicated earlier. DNA analysis is performed in respect of murder currently and sexual offenses in order to establish links between crime scene suspects and victims. Other DNA investigations or analysis that are done now with regards to paternity tests and when identifying human remains or missing persons, perhaps after disasters. Now, these are some of the concerns that were raised by the previous ad hoc committee that looked at this bill, and in the papers that we've distributed to honorable members, we do have all this information in great detail. Just here is a summary or a highlight of what is in there. So I will urge members to go to the documents themselves and read through and thoroughly. But just to highlight one of the things that were said, or the question that was raised, was what is being done to address problems at station level in respect of the preservation of evidence in the SAP 13. The SAP 13 is a book that you use to record all the exhibits that have been brought in from the crime scene. Sometimes not only exhibits that are linked to the crime, but anything that needs to be kept safe in the at the police station. Now, the example that was given was a blood-stained shirt that was damaged by moisture at a certain police station, and which could not be used in the court as evidence. Now, the problem that this brings is that there is a level of negligence at police station level, because before all exhibits and all DNA samples and everything goes to the lab, it starts at the police station where crime investigation is. And if DNA samples are not, all exhibits are not being taken care of at that level, then we'll have a problem. So the issue that was being raised is that we need to ensure that while we are looking at how the lab will function, we also need to ensure that at station level, where the preliminary storage of these samples will take place, will take place in a proper environment, and there won't be any negligence that will may lead to samples of exhibits being damaged. The other issue that was raised, the problem with laboratory not currently being independent from the SAPS, as I've mentioned, and as to what safeguards would they like, or would the SAPS like to see in place. And the response, obviously, that is convenient from the SAPS was that up to now, or up to then, it has not been a problem for the laboratory to be located under the SAPS, as there has not been any interference with the activities of the laboratory from the side of the SAPS. However, the issue might be necessary to be looked at by the committee and for the future. Now, yes, the SAPS wouldn't say, yeah, we do agree there are serious problems with the laboratory being located under us. But as I've said earlier, the committee will need to interrogate that matter and see the appropriate thing to do. The current investigative database of the DNA, I think my colleagues have mentioned this one, that the current investigative database of the DNA laboratory is not an instant database. It is therefore necessary to amend Section 37 of the Criminal Procedure Act to establish a national database. And basically, that is it on my side. And then members of Parliament can now raise questions, if any. Oh, Jeremy, yeah, quickly. How can I forget you? You are so unforgettable.
Been mentioned earlier, members are aware that this bill originally were introduced and referred to an ARA committee earlier this year. And I'm just quickly going to take you through the report of the ARA committee. And you'll notice that most of the things that were highlighted by my colleagues also highlighted in this report. So the bill was introduced and was referred to the ARA committee on the 13th of January to report by 23 January, which of course is in 10 days to try and process the bill through Parliament. It's almost impossible. The composition of the ARA committee, the ARA committee was composed of members of the National Assembly, consisting of ANC members, DA, IFP, MF, and UDM. The committee requested on more than one occasion, in fact, extension, and finally reported on the 23rd of March. The public participation process basically was kicked off with adverts in 5 national newspapers inviting written submissions. 10 written submissions were received, of which 6 stakeholders participated in the public hearings. Members received additional members in the individual capacity, of course, received additional submissions after the closing date, which could not be considered due to time constraints. The Department of Justice presented 95 written submissions, the majority of which were individuals expressing support for the bill. The visits to the Crime Record Center, the Forensic Science Labs in Pretoria. The committee, of course, visited the Record Center, the Forensic Science Lab, and the purpose of this visit was basically to assess the organizational structure, personnel strength, staff turnover and resources, training needs, and budget allocation of these structures. Members raised a number of concerns, which, of course, my colleagues have also alluded to. These concerns were around the lack of information on future plans to address the capacity building, scarce skills, personnel shortage in order to achieve objectives of the bill, the national rollout strategy of the final, the fully automated robotic analyzing processing machines, the intensive increased capacity and training of police at station level in the handling of DNA samples. Processing of the bill, the Department of Justice briefed the committee on the objectives of the bill. That was followed by an analysis from the Parliamentary Research Unit, followed by public hearings and, of course, deliberations on the bill. During deliberations, a number of issues emerged which require further consideration. The committee had limited time to consider the bill, and the implementation plan from steps was outstanding during deliberation stage. The committee's findings, which is also contained in your documents and, of course, elaborate much further, is the process of the public hearings was limited due to time constraints, and more time should be afforded for public hearings. The bill is important in the fight against crime and a crucial element in revamping the criminal justice system. However, time constraints hampered the committee's progress on the bill. Research provided to the committee revealed that DNA sampling raised serious legal challenges in other countries, for example, the right to privacy, the powers of police to take bodily samples without court warrants, retention and sampling in DNA database. No final decision on these matters was taken by the committee. Furthermore, the management and control of DNA services was also of concern. The fact that little is known about DNA sampling and profiling in South Africa, and concerns about implementation of the legislation, and which require, of course, more time to scrutinize the implementation plan. The recommendation by the ERA committee was simple. It was that this bill should be considered by this parliament as a matter of urgency. Developments between then and now is that this bill in the meantime has been deferred to this committee, further stating that this committee should confer with the Portfolio Committee on Justice and any other committee it deems necessary to confer with. Of course, in terms of the way forward, that I'll then just allow the chairperson to speak to as far as that's concerned. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for the presentation. It's been a long marathon one. Let me welcome Honorable Mulek Georgi, Honorable Chawuke, to our meeting. Indeed, we have to finalize this bill. I will take questions from members, but let me suggest for now that probably let us not engage on the way forward as to how we intend processing this bill, because indeed tomorrow we'll also be meeting the department which will be tabling before us its implementation plan on the bill, and from there we can then move forward. But we have this information now with us, and I should think we have options to choose from as to how we take this process forward as a portfolio committee, but let me suggest that we don't deal with that for now. But we have had this long but very important information sharing session, and we can take clarity seeking questions from the members. You know, a very technical bill. Whilst it is law, in fact it is a bill, but it's very technical. You know, I was just sitting thinking, and as BC was talking, to say maybe we've not had challenges with our forensic laboratories and the results. I know of a child who has a resemblance of his father in every manner, but the DNA results came back saying he's definitely not the father. And the magistrate ruled as such. But he comes here and that man comes here, he's a father. There's no doubt about it. He's his resemblance. You know, he's black, but the father has blue eyes. You know, mine are, the iris is black. The father has blue eyes and the child has blue eyes. He's a resemblance of the father. The father happened to be a police. So you can actually tell. So you would conclude that there might be some tampering in the whole processing of taking that blood, you know, transporting it to the lab and so on. Because that man is the father. You don't have to ask, he is. But the result that he is definitely not the father. There are no chances that he can be the first. let's take questions from the members, clarity seeking questions from the members. Honorable Ndlovu, Honorable Chawuke, Honorable Reverend Mishwe, Honorable Fred, in that order.
Chair, thank you very much for the information. I think the information is very good because although they have bombarded us with information, we are very old to get all this information at the same time. But have everybody? Jefferson, can you just protect me from...
You are protected from the...
I'm speaking about myself. I'm not speaking about child yourself. I know that you are very young.
mind on so
Chairperson, no. My clarity question is the safeguard of privacy. I really want to know, because if we can talk about countries, we can talk about what the other countries are doing. But we talk about privacy. At the end of the day, privacy. And secondly, the time frame. The time frame of 5 years. Where did you get the 5 years? Of what? Of whom? According to us. If we think about, is a person who has been convicted or not convicted, or is just a person, or every 47 million of South Africans, or who are we talking about of these 5 years or whatever? Those are the two questions that I just want to clear with you on.
Thank you very much. I apologize for coming in. The point I want to raise, Chair, is that the issue that we are dealing with, it is not just a small issue of, you know, collecting DNA. It touches on the rights of individuals. And clearly, I think the research has done it quite very well to identify those areas that are very critical. My experience, Chair, on these issues, I once engaged on the issue of the harness system. But not only the RANA system, the national identification system. What about the question of, because they raise the issue of one center of information? Because I see that you did touch it, of this, what you call a system that are not linked. I mean, you have your AFIS, you have your ANAS, and you have this police thing. Now, I think that's where the crack of the matter comes in. And at the same time, I mean, you'll want a situation where we have one database, and that database may be either including the DNA in it, which is something else different. The issue I want to understand further, Chair, is this issue of the rights that you have identified here. In Germany, for example, when they were doing the national identification system, that what they call the this thing where people participate, why you call the public to participate in the referendum, because it becomes so important that these are the rights of individuals. There's nobody in fact who would want this DNA to be kept somewhere without that right. I think the issue of the right comes in. And I think it's an area, Chair, that maybe we may want to hammer on it quite detailed. The constitutional, you know, rights of individuals. And it's something that we may not want to pass it, meaning that as we move forward, Chair, I think it's an area that will need us. I'm not saying there are other constitutional aspects outside ourselves, because we wrote the constitution at the end of the day. But I think it's an area, because even the research at the end of the presentation, they raises the issue of the constitutionality and the question of the implementation and restoring of this data. I thought maybe the report of the portfolio committee, the ad hoc committee, will have said that we're satisfied about where the police currently are operating on their particular, you know, unit. Because the security of that information is very critical. It's information exactly what you have just raised, Chair. That someone who is the father to this child, and you can clearly identify as the father, but is able to manipulate the system. Now, either you're going to put the state into a very serious strife, because they're going to be suing the state left and right if that question of security is not addressed. But the three areas that you raised of the three departments, I remember in 1996 when this whole thing started, the National Identification System, it was to include the DNA information. Now, that in fact was messed up by Transport. The Transport then moved away and then went further to create their own data system. Home Affairs is still struggling even today. And it's information you cannot rely on, because your national population register, it's highly contaminated, you can't even rely on that information. Now, but I understand where the police wants to go. It's what, how you summarize it, to to address the issues of crime that we're facing. Therefore, I think we need to move away then from the entire that national identification. We must just move away and agree that the approach in which we take is to give police capacity to deal with levels of crime. So therefore, you'll have to look at the capacity of the police. This is what you are raising. The cost that will go with implementing this bill. I think it's one thing that they will have to look at. The issue of the rights, I think for me, these are issues that we want to hammer further, either by, you know, further opening this thing for the public. I'm not sure as to how far the JADO committee go with regard to these issues of rights with public participation. Again, you may find that your ordinary people, where some of us come from, would not even know that there was once a call for public participation on this issue. And tomorrow a person is arrested and is made to give blood samples, hair, you know, saliva, and all of those things that form part of the DNA. And, you know, you may find ourselves having infringed, you know, all of these rights. But I'm looking at a situation where there's this open general participation. In other countries, they do it via referendum, because we are now dealing with something which is quite very detailed about me. I mean, if you have to keep my information, I would definitely want to know where is that information, how safe is that information. So I think maybe there may be issues that we may still want to engage further around. I don't have answers now, but I thought that you have raised these issues to us, that I think we should begin to look at all, especially the three areas that you raised, the constitutionality, impact of it, the implementation of the bill itself. Do police have capacity? You raise the very same question, that others prefer to have this thing privatized. And if it's privatized, again, how safe you are? Because if it's privatized by, for example, PricewaterhouseCoopers, they may decide to use it as they want, and the state does not have a control. And in fact, we have opened up the public to what's called to give their data into someone who's private, and the state does not own it. And those are quite implications again. The issue of sharing of this information. This is private, very detailed information, and obvious. I hear you talk of, in some countries they've put regulations on one, but you will not share with us exactly how they in fact regulate the sharing and the keeping of this information. You just raise them as, you know, a example, but you will not have that detail. I think we'll need more experience share around these issues, of, so that, you know, we are able to say as the state, the police, yes, have capacity, they can keep this thing safe, and the public understand and agree that we can keep that. That you raise those issues. The issue of the cost, 9 billion, 19 billion, what informs this cost? Someone has sit somewhere looking at that and say either, you know, I mean, if you are forensic expert, some of them will have looked at how much we can benefit out of this cost. But I don't want to get to that level now. But I'm saying, what informs this cost? If someone says we're looking at about 19 billion, and you don't share with the committee, in fact, that's where the detail lies, that either you're going to create a new lab, either we're going to merge all these units together and have one unit, and then the capacity of that unit will be at this level, you know. So I think that there's still going to be a need that we begin to open up this whole thing. I mean, looking at the issue of that cost and all of that. So I think, Chair, all in all is that it's something that we want to support, but we'll have to make sure that we really follow what the Constitution requires. If there's going to be amendment to the Constitution to limit this right of those who are found to be guilty, whatever, I think we'll have to look at those, what kind of amendment we're going to bring in, so that when you say we're going to limit this right, because your prisoners, they still have a right today. I mean, they have the right to watch TV, they have the right for clean uniform, clean food, clean bed, and all of that. So at what level do you then limit this right? That only those who are, you know, arrested and found guilty can, you know, police can keep that DNA or can take that DNA and all of that. So I think these are some of the areas that we may want to further engage around those. Those are quite fundamental areas. It's not something that you can just pass and say, we agree, police can have a DNA. We, when I was still sitting on the other committee, the issue of DNA came in, and we were able to separate it. And in fact, you know, out of all your fingerprints and all of that, they were saying we have capacity to take fingerprints. And we were saying that, but you don't have. You don't even have a storage where you keep your own fingerprint record. I mean, the population register currently is in the state of shambles. So how far, then, can you have a security to keep DNA? You know, so we're able to separate that question. So I'm simply saying that it's something that it will want us really to engage a further detail on it, and but try at the same time to help the police to resolve the challenges that are facing. Thank you.
I trust you, I must apologize for arriving late. I'm not in his team. which normally arrives. It's just that the plane, I thought I would make it to arrive at there are two things which I don't know whether they should be answered here, but I think we need to deal with it very seriously. My previous experience with police, especially the Firearms Control Act. No, the question was asked 100 times. Do you have the money to implement the bill? And the answer was positive all the time. But when the bill was signed by the president, that bill took about more than 5 years before the bill was implemented. They were asked, do you have the capacity to implement the bill? I think the question they are raising. And they said, yes. Now my question is, how will we be sure that the bill is properly budgeted? Because what they did last in the previous, in my experience with them, that they'll come and give you something which does not exist. And then you go ahead. Because I think in my view, first we must first establish that. Do they have the capacity? Will they be able to implement the bill? Is the bill properly budgeted? Is there money to implement it? Because if there is no money. But also I think what we must look at, again, to me, I think the committee must exercise is the issue of the constitutionality. You know, there are things that worry me in this bill. You know, we are here, some of us, to defend the Constitution. And we're the only people who are here to defend the Constitution. The use of force against all people and not just accused people. I can tell you straight away that won't fly in Christian law. There's no way. You see, it's like some of the things that people are proposing, but we'll deal with them, only deal with them. You see, trying to give the police more power than they deserve when they cannot do their job. It's not a question that they don't have power. So I'm just saying...
I think...
No, wait a minute.
Let's focus on this.
No, I'm coming to this one.
Yeah.
I'm saying the use of force is to me something which... We must look, is it constitutional? Because sometimes it takes time to go ahead. There are certain things which worry me in this thing. Taking fingerprints on everybody, even ordinary citizens. Because unfortunately in South Africa, taking fingerprints is associated with criminality. I don't believe that I'll agree to any small monkey constable or stopping me and say, I want to take your fingerprints because I've got reasonable ground. Because also, we must know what constitutes this reasonable ground. To be stopped and be told that I've got reasonable ground.
Honorable member, can I really request you not to address police as monkeys? Can you really withdraw that? Because it can't be correct that we address anybody but our officials as monkeys. I think it is extremely out of order.
Okay, I'm sorry, I'll withdraw. But what I'm saying, I don't want to list all of them, I've only listed two. But what I'm saying, we need to look at the constitutionality of this bill. The aspect which worry me very, very. Yeah. I mean, this thing of stopping everybody, the crime might be crime high in South Africa. But I believe that most South Africans are good people. In fact, the majority. So it's just that the criminals operate in such a manner that people think that criminals are more. The majority of South Africans are good people. And for them to be assumed, I'm saying the constitutionality to me worries me a lot.
Chairperson, the first question has to do with why our portfolio committee is dealing with this bill and not the justice, because of the many constitutional issues that are raised by the bill. Why is it not the justice committee dealing with this bill? And the second one has to do again with the issue of resources and capacity. I mean, looking at our program, almost three times a week we have to sit on this bill. Now, at the end of the year, or at the end of deliberation, will the police have the capacity and the resources to implement the bill? If not, why the rush? And thirdly, I want to know at what stage the DNA test will be taken from a person. At what stage? Because it's true that some people may be arrested incorrectly, unlawfully, because of wrong information. Now, if that happens, and the DNA test has been done, we don't have clear directives of what's going to happen to that information. So, at what stage is what I really want to know? Is the DNA test going to be required of any person who's arrested? Thank you.
No, thanks, Chair. I've been covered on the constitutionality issues as well as the cost implications, so I won't ask on that. But what I want to ask of the research department is just they spoke about, well, firstly, in their presentation, it talks about the forensic science laboratories and the higher rate of turnover. And then later on, staff turnover. But later on in the presentation, they then talk about the they motivate, and I'm trying to find it here, the use of private laboratories. Now, what I'd like to find out is, firstly, is have they been able to establish in their own research the real reasons for the high turnover rate? I mean, I have heard that stories about the fact that they go for higher salaries, that type of thing. I'm not too sure, but can we get that? But then, secondly, what's the turnover rate in the private laboratories? Is there a high turnover there as well? That's the question I'd like to ask. But then, linked to that is, in other countries, what is the general practice? Do they use state laboratories, or do they use private laboratories? It'd be interesting to know what are some of the other countries do, how they handle that. Doctor, I think that's really my questions. I mean, I've got other questions, but those would be really directed to the department. And this is the research section here, so it's not really fair to ask them those questions. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you.
Chair,
I'll mine is on authorized person. It goes on to say any police. So I'm a bit worried about the any part. Can't we have a specific designated police to do it, not any police? Because I think it's going to open it up to corruption if it's any. Thanks.
Yeah, thank you very much for the question. The research on countries, information on countries that have these laboratories, you referred to, I think, UK, US, and Canada, if I'm not mistaken. And are they the only ones? Because I was really interested in knowing whether countries that are developing like ourselves, or even underdeveloped for that matter, do have these forensic laboratories. Because the ones that you have mentioned for me are first world countries. And therefore the challenges that they might be having may necessarily not be the same as ourselves who are developing or even underdeveloped for that matter. I may not claim to have read everything about this bill, but there is nothing referring to the Human Tissue Act in this bill. I'm not very sure. I even thought that maybe it no longer exists, because while it is not mentioned in this bill, but you're talking about your hair, your blood, and that is human tissue. And there is an act, as far as I know, called Human Tissue Act, and it doesn't appear anywhere in this bill. Is it because it's not applicable, it's not at all affected by this bill? I also wanted to check on that one. I just wanted to just emphasize one thing, that this bill is referred to ourselves for conferral with justice, the portfolio committee. But I said probably it will not be right and not be correct for now to discuss the way forward. And I was actually saying that in this meeting, considering all these issues, you know, some of us are new in the portfolio committee, and therefore we're hearing this information for the first time, and therefore you can actually be able to judge, to say this is the way forward, it might not be that easy. And therefore, I thought after tomorrow's meeting, where we will be told about the implementation plan, then we can then be in a position to say, no, this should be the way forward, following this, which we have heard from the department. Should we rush the bill? Should we delay the bill? Should we, and so on and so forth. But let me mention the fact that there is pressure that this bill must be finalized, because it actually talks to the renewal of the justice system. I mean, just criminal justice system, it talks to that. And it is a way of trying to address this fragmentation or in the system itself. It is arrested today, gets the bill, gets arrested the following day. Nobody knows that it's the same thing who's arrested the second time. Not even the police station that arrested her yesterday is aware that she's arrested the same thing. So those are the challenges that are there. But I don't think we're in a position today to can actually informatively so discuss that. But let me then hand over to the presenters.
Thank you, Chairperson. Thank you, honourable members. As the one member rightly said, some of these questions, or maybe the majority of them, have actually been raised for the purpose that the department can engage with the committee on this. And just from my side, especially just looking at what I was required to do for the presentation, was looking at the structure of the bill. So the issues that I highlighted was more looking at what does the bill say and trying to align that with what the intentions are of the draft and look at how those issues or the provisions in the bill can be improved to bring out the what the objects of the bill actually are. If I may, Chairperson, there was one question that was asked about the sharing of information. And I just wanted to direct the members' attention to where that provision specifically in on page 15 of the bill, section 15M, which speaks about foreign law enforcement agencies. That's the last part of the bill on that page. And then if you look at subsection 3, it speaks about any steps taken under the subsection 1 or 2 other than requests relating to missing persons or unidentified human remains that do not relate to the detection of crime, the investigation of an offender, or the conduction of a prosecution must be in accordance with the provisions of the International Cooperation in Criminal Matters Act and it also speaks about existing species and or an existing species. So basically, what we try to highlight with the with bringing this up in the presentation is the bill speaks about it, but is that sufficient information given here to, for instance, the question that the members asked around the type of information that can be divulged and to whom it can be, the framework that governs the divulging of information in this regard, DNA or anything related to that. So basically just to ask that question, is the provision as it stands at the moment, is it sufficient? And can that provision be improved to make sure that only the purpose for such information is strictly governed in terms of the bill? So I'm going to go give over to my colleagues to just address some of the questions that may be applicable to them. Thank you, Chairperson. With regard to the question about privacy safeguards regarding privacy in the bill, this is specifically within the bill itself. The information taken from the DNA samples may only be used for investigation, detection, and prosecution of crime. The bill makes it a criminal offense if it's used for any other purpose. So, and there is a sanction of up to 15 years of imprisonment for misuse of the samples. Whether the bill also deals with privacy protection by private labs. So if a private lab is analyzing the DNA sample, then there's a specific provision within the bill that says that they need to have safeguards, and if they misuse the information, then this is a criminal offense itself. With regard to the retention, the five-year time frame, who does it apply to? The bill is very specific about who this applies to. It applies to people who are arrested and after 5 years have not been convicted of an offense. So basically, it's people who have, there's no criminal proceedings taken further after 5 years, if that clarifies that, to the honorable member. With regard to the Human Tissue Act, Chairperson, we will provide further information. It's something that we will look into, and we will provide a brief information sheet on the matter to the committee. Regarding first world countries and developing countries, the most information we could obtain was from the United Kingdom and the United States because their labs are quite developed and they're the benchmark. In terms of South Africa, in fact, many other neighboring countries use South Africa to analyze their DNA samples. They don't have established labs, but we will provide further information about other countries in Africa, North Africa, West Africa, as to what they do with the DNA.
Thank you very much. I thought because we have rain. Oh. Thanks, Chairperson. I want to assume that the questions that my colleagues have left are obviously directed to me and I have to respond to them. So I have no choice. I want to bring to the attention of the committee that, as you correctly said, Chairperson, that most members are new and they are not familiar with these issues. And it was a mammoth task even for the previous ad hoc committee that looked at this. But they managed. And we are privileged in this particular committee to have members who were present in that previous committee. One is the Honorable Annalise and Honorable Kola Panadi. They will assist, you know, in most of the matters because they were there, and as we know them as to be vibrant members, they will assist, you know. But as you correctly said, that this bill is essential as it talks directly to the review of the criminal justice system. And one of the things that I would like to highlight, perhaps just responding to this, to the question about the other countries developing and developing, either in Africa and elsewhere, is that South Africa is taking a giant leap in this regard. Most developing countries do not have such systems.
and you find that they do not even have the DNA analysis capacities. So, as you are saying, that talk to the review of the criminal justice system, and it is a major leap, and even financially, it will cost. So, most developing countries do not have. In Africa, it's Cairo, Egypt, and ourselves that have such services. And other African countries in the SADC region, we also assist them, like Zimbabwe, Malawi, other countries, Swaziland. Yeah, so we assist them with some of the analysis in serious cases of that will involve the DNA samples. And one of the countries in Brazil, in South America or Latin America, is one of the countries that is still climbing the ladder. Other European countries, such as Estonia, Germany is well developed in this regard, and there's Australia as well. But in the paper that I did regarding the location, abuse, location, and ownership of crime laboratories, all this information is there in great detail. So the committee will benefit through reading this this document. And I also highlight the issue that has been raised by members that in us as a nation taking such a giant leap, we need not rush this matter because it's so complex. It is difficult to understand, and we need to carefully look at each and every aspect of it. That perhaps, as the honorable member said, that the state might be sued left, right, and center if this bill is not looked at carefully. So the issue of time, of course, is one of the things that is raised in the bill, that we need to allow ourselves as a nation to look at it carefully and also ensure that it's watertight. One of the questions that was raised was why is there a high level of turnover in the crime lab, and whether that rate is commensurate to what is happening in the private sector. And the rate of turnover, I think the department as well, we will be able to respond to that and explain as to why there's such a high level of turnover. But one of the things that my colleagues highlighted earlier is that the entry level, when a person comes from university or wherever, after having done internship through a private lab, you find that the entry level in terms of salaries is very low, and it's not competitive, or it cannot be compared to what is being earned elsewhere or outside in the private sector. And so private sector, including overseas companies, do poach these people because of the type of experience that they receive, particularly in this division in the SAPS, because they look at a wide variety of issues, and that enhances their experience, and therefore they become, easy targets. And what do other countries use? Whether are these labs located privately or they are state-owned? They are mostly state-owned. However, in the U.S., there are certain states that privatize certain aspects of DNA analysis, not the entire thing, but the major stakeholder or the major stakeholder in the DNA analysis in the U.S. is said to be the FBI, which is controlling at the national level the DNA analysis. Then each state may have its own laboratories, but mainly they are owned by government. And in the in the UK as well, it's the same thing. And the people who have raised the arguments that some of these services or these services should be privatized are people who are in countries where they see these services being state-owned, and particularly being in the police department. Because one of the suggestions is that it may be state-owned, but be located elsewhere, not in the police department, say in the justice department, or in the health department, for that matter. In other countries, the criminal justice system is designed in the sense that you have the Department of Home Affairs having the police as part of Home Affairs, and other various law enforcement and justice services within or under the umbrella of Home Affairs, and it becomes easier to locate these labs and also to share information, as you said, like HANIS, IFIS. Here in South Africa, everything is fragmented. But if you have it perhaps under one department that shares one database, every aspect of that umbrella department can be able to access that information. So, yeah, I'll pause there for now.
But I think it's pausing on the version that you should have to do that for me. This is, I think, very fundamental. The last issue of the sharing, I'll tell you there, we'll just have a little bit. I think that's the issue. But we definitely have to engage that, as much as I think we'll want to transform the criminal justice system. And it may not be only the solution to address that particular point. Therefore, I think there's going to be a need to revert to back to how then, because I remember during the budget vote of the police, they raised a very same issue, the sharing of information. I don't want to go back to the issue of the constitution again, and I think it's something that will need us to set out for. The capacity, with your view obvious, having interacted with the lab, and then clearly that the capacity is like every day is being drained to zero. The concern of the committee of yours will be if we had passed this bill next week, so I'm just giving an example, will the department be able, how long will it take the department to implement this bill? And it's a point that was raised by a member that I can't mention because he's from COVID, so normally I can't mention people from
COVID.
So therefore, I think very critical will be to look at that part of implementation. We'll have to engage with those labs, Chair, as this committee, and respecting the fact that the previous members have done a lot of work. And I think because we're saying that we're not going to be rushing just to jump because we understand what is at stake. But I think there will be a need for us to engage with those labs again. So we are able to, you know, arrest this, you know, draining of, you know, your technical people into the system. I know you're, the main thing would be your salary, as you say, the entry level that works for. And I think the department, these are some of the things that it's supposed to address. People get poached because you don't pay them. And they leave the watch for the system. I mean, at all levels of the department, not only the police, but, you know, this is what you find. The doctors are leaving because we don't pay them sometimes. But, and I think that health department is beginning to address those issues. And I think these are things that we must look at ourselves. That we want to give capacity to this, you know, unit of the police. And these are the challenges. And let's begin to address them. So by the time we say that we now have given you extra, you know, capacity, because DNA is not just going to be a small thing that we give to the police. And we are satisfied ourselves. And the notion that we'll give this thing to the private hands, I think it's something that, Chair, we still have to engage federally. But we must be satisfied ourselves that those labs that we have currently are well functioning and we are addressing the challenges that they are faced with. Without addressing those challenges, we'll add more responsibility to them and the whole thing then collapses. Or either we go and create something that would not even talk to anybody, you know, within the system, in fact. The Home Affairs will not access it, the criminal, I mean, your court and whoever will not access that information. So we need to begin, I think, to work on, at some point, in fact, this committee can start to champion the issue of one database. I think this committee can start to do that, to make that call. Each department is spending billions of money. The police spends billions, Home Affairs does that, Transport does that, Social Development does that, they have their own data there at the corner. Everybody has their own data. And I think it's an area that we should sort of begin to called for, which in 1996, when the harness thing was started, it went, in fact, they missed that point. And so that to enhance the police again, because not only they are not going to rely on DNA only, they are still going to rely on fingerprints, they are still going to rely on the population register, you know, which has so many people that are not supposed to be in that population register. So I think, Chair, for me, it's a good thing that we are at this level. But I think we have to give leadership here. You know, we'll definitely have to give leadership. We'll have to be there at some point with the executive. And there's nothing wrong that stops this committee to invite the executive at the level that I've just spoken about. And invite them and say, here is the situation that we have to deal with. And therefore, this call has been made. Analysts will tell you how much this call was made of sharing of 1 cent of data piece. Many times. And it does not happen. It does not happen. That has led to the state losing a lot of money, that people come in and claim that want to do a proper system and they lose the money and they go away. And I think we can give the leaders this committee to say, but you, the executive, here's the situation. At this point in time, you agree that you want to have one database and it's not happening. Give us the guys. So by the time we give you this responsibility, we're very certain, because Home Affairs is going to come and say, we are now implementing the smart card. In the smart card, we want information of DNA into the smart card. And transport will come and say, we are not doing the smart, what's called a license. In the smart license, we want DNA. You see, so I think, Chair, that for me, is to say that it's a good start, but let us begin to engage further and begin to identify these issues and address them.
I was going to have questions and not make a speech. They made talk about limitation of rights. I think both of them, if not all three of them. Now my question is, does it mean already that, because the limitation of rights is in Section 36 of the Constitution, does it mean already we're going to have to deal with that aspect of the Constitution? If so, do they have an idea? The second one, all three of them, when they talk about this, they talk about safeguards. I mean, when these things are done, I mean, it doesn't matter whether it's done by the police. There's going to be some corruption. And to me, even if it's done by private, there will still be corruption. I heard them talk about safeguards. I don't want them to answer now, Comrade Chair. Do they have something written about these safeguards? I see it's in the document. I've not seen the document. If that is the case, then I'll read it in the document.
Chairperson, there are two things that are very important in this committee, which maybe I must speak on it. You know, I always respect the members of this committee very much. And I respect the chairperson on the committee. And I respect the members too. And I'm requesting that the members respect each other too, so that we are able to work as brothers and sisters in this committee. Because if we don't want to do that, we can take a different position and we can insult each other. At the end of the day, it won't work. I'm trying to say, Chairperson, when we are posing questions on the matter, it's a matter of clarity, because they are just the researchers. There are words that we can use, there are statements that we can use, and we must be very careful as members of Parliament how do we use those words and so on and so forth, because these are members of the staff, especially. They are not politicians and so on and so forth. Therefore, we must be very careful of what you are thinking. That's my preamble of my... It seems as if, Chairperson, we have three main tasks to look at this. And I'm concerned about the rights of individuals. Really the rights of individuals. And I'm concerned about the time factor, the 5 years. Who does it apply to? If you say it applies to the convicted, why did it apply to the convicted? Why doesn't it apply to me if I'm not convicted?
If I'm arrested, then why does it apply? You see, there are so many things that you can ask on the time frame. The time frame itself, it's questionable. And everything boils down to capacity and the space to do that. Now, there are other... When there was a response, even Mr. Mbisi talked about even health department and so on. You see, there are so many departments that does these things when we're talking about any official in the police. But in other documents, we talk about medical practitioner. You see, now, we have to be very, very careful because we don't want to stay in court every now and then when we pass the speed. And the state has been sued every now and then because of a slight mistake that we have done in the bill. That's why we must safeguard on the bill. It's not that we mustn't do the bill correctly, but we must be very, very, very cautious of what we are dealing with. Thank you, Chairperson.
I don't know whether you want to say something before we close.
Regarding the constitutionality of issues and the limitation clause, when you determine whether a right has been infringed, firstly you determine the extent of the right and whether the law is violating the right. Once that is established, you then determine in terms of Section 36 whether the limitation of the right is justified. So as soon as a person alleges that the right has been infringed, the state uses Section 36 to justify the limitation. So if you're going to say the right to privacy by taking DNA samples is infringed, the question that the state will counter this by saying they have a reason to limit the right, and the committee must decide, is this reason justifiable, taking into consideration all the tests in Section 36. So the limitation clause will come into play as soon as the right is alleged to be infringed.
Chairperson, I don't want to take the committee back, and I know you want to close, but I think that we desperately need to have, from the state law advisor's side, not necessarily today, an input also on the constitutionality of some of these areas. I don't know whether it was raised, but for instance, the children and the obligation on the child at the age of 18 to remove their name, and whether that should not be an automatic removal when the child turns 18, should the obligation be on the child? And I also think, Chairperson, that I agree with what Mr. Choke has said, that we must deal with this legislation carefully. And I think some of these answers we need to have before we actually start dealing with it in detail. And we must also consider whether it's not possible to implement some part of this legislation before you implement other parts of this legislation. I think there's less problems around the fingerprint issues and the coordination of the different databases and the access for such to the different databases. There's less constitutional issues around that as well. The issues are around the DNA part of it. And maybe one of the things that we might want to consider is to say, but let's look at, first of all, at the database issue, the fingerprint access, and pass that. And then let's look at the DNA part of it as well. So basically what I'm saying, even if we have to deal with this legislation in a two-pronged approach, we should consider that as well. We should be open to that possibility as well.
Yes, indeed, I want to close this meeting so that we make place for buses and transport to our parks. You promised that you will come back to us with regard to the issue of human tissue. And is it possible that we can give you time frame? Maybe by Monday next week. Yes, because the Human Tissue Act is there, if I'm not mistaken, I think it's 1968, before this constitution. But it is still working even today. I'm really upset because I don't understand why it was not quoted. I can't understand, because it actually tells us what is a human tissue, and these things that I hear, they talk to that act, and as far as I'm concerned. I'm not a lawyer, but I know. Thank you very much.
Chauke.
Thank you very much for the presentation. And I think thank you very much for the quality work that you put in your presentation. Thank you, Research PC, for leading the team that presents such high quality work. This is real good. I'm not going to lose these presentations, believe you me, because I think they're going to help us as we move on. Whether how we approach this bill, but I think it's going to assist us a great deal. It makes us able to prepare questions to ask to whoever will come before the portfolio committee with regard to this bill. We remain open to any further engagement on this bill, not only in the meetings, but even after, outside the meetings, on anything, because indeed we do not want to pass any act or any bill that is not constitutional. And the sooner we get to know that, the better, than to be informed at the tail end of the process that this bill is unconstitutional. Or we finalize, we pass the bill, and people go to court today and tomorrow to challenge the act that has been passed. So we remain open to any input from anywhere on anything that is in this bill. And I want to thank you all for attending the meeting, and this meeting is opening now. It's closed. Thank you.